Welcome, brave listeners, to another episode of Frightening Tales, the sponsor-free podcast that spooks listeners each week with another original story donated by writers from around the world. Fans of Frightening Tales are implored to go out and find more content by our weekly authors or to share Frightening Tales with those around you. By doing so, you will invite more authors to want to share their tales here. And then I'll never run out of stories to read you. If you are an author with a dark piece of fiction that would like to share with us, please submit it through FrighteningTales.com. While you're there, tap into more than 30 hours of previous content. Today's tale was written by Curtis K. Stadfield. Not much is known about this week's author, and it was a rather strange incident how the tale came into my possession. The story was found in a listing of literature that was no longer rights managed due to its age and the passing on of its author. While working away at my desk one day, it was just one of many windows open on my screen. I read the tale and did some research into who the author was, but couldn't find anything on him. It's as though old Curtis himself wanted me to read it. Well, who am I to disappoint? So without further ado, here is Curtis K. Stadfield's In the Field of the Dying Cherry Tree. As a child, I was terrified of the cherry tree field. I did not know what it was that affected me so. Not that a child needs reasons for terror. I knew, though, that no other place on the vast farm sent such heart-stopping apprehension thrilling through me every time I went there. The sensation that something waited just beyond sight or feeling, something wrong and frightening. There, in the field of the great dying cherry tree. Many other places on the farm might seem more threatening. There was, for instance, a deep wood that settled gradually into a tangled swamp, and there were places far into the swamp where the maze of untouched trees and fallen logs and primordial growth lay in ranks so thick that the sounds of the settled world vanished. And children venturing there heard nothing that had not been heard 1,000 years earlier. Of course, we told stories in those days, my brothers and sisters and I, to the limits of our imagination, stories of monsters, of ghosts. Such creatures would have thrived in those deep swamps, and I could have feared them. But I did not. We went there to pick flowers, and now and then we played hide and seek in the trackless wild. Fear of the swamp was an adult fear, and it came later. Even on the way to that far corner of the farm where the cherry tree field lay, there were places where I might have been afraid. The lane ran at one point, through a willow swamp. And by midsummer, the willow's yellow blossoms had vanished, and tall saplings rising far above a child's sight tipped across the lane and sent rolling shadows over the tracks. The willows grew thick, and their roots went deep to seek and hold moisture. A child knows without being told that it is in these moist, steamy, warm, unvisited places that odd things grow. Still, we were not afraid. The willow swamp was our hideout, and the curling trail cut an opening we used as a fort. We knew we would not be surprised there. We talked about the outlaws who hid out in the willow swamp, but we did not believe in them, for we had invented them ourselves. I walked on the lane barefoot, and perhaps I laughed a little nervously sometimes, but I was not afraid. The field with the cherry tree standing alone out in the middle of it was as far from the house and barn as we could go without trespassing on someone else's land. It was nearly 3/4 of a mile back the lane, past 1,000 landmarks. Far for a child to go, even on the magic errand of calling a father home for supper. The field itself was bleak and almost barren. Crops there were never quite as good as they should have been. The slope where the cherry tree stood was strewn with rocks, the broken bones of the earth, scattered there as though the earth had fought a visceral battle with itself. But the lane that led there was a happy one, for there were bluebirds in the hollow posts along the way, and there was our father at the end of the journey to call home to supper. We could ride home with him as our reward for ending his long day in the hot, dry dust of the field. Sometimes I would ride on his shoulders or high on the steaming back of one of the weary horses. Or we might bounce along on the iron seat of one of the primitive machines he used to cultivate the land. Even more than in the field, strangeness lay within the tree itself. It was a cankerous claw clutching at the sky, its bark flaking off like snake scales, twigs littering the ground. It was a big tree, not the kind that grows cherries for pies, but a wild cherry tree, and if it had been healthy, its wood would have made that tine red lumber prized for furniture. It may have been left standing for that reason. Someone might have hoped to harvest it one day to make furniture of it or sell it at a good price. It was perhaps 50 feet high. The trunk too large to reach around, several of its limbs had the girth of a ship's mast. Once it had the promise of becoming a majestic tree, but now it was a rotting wreck, with spaces in the trunk where unknown things hold up, whole branches dead, and some years hardly more than a token of foliage. It was dying, but it had been dying for as long as anyone could remember. Anything dying is an affront to a farmer whose business is to nurture growing things. One would have expected the tree to be taken down, not just because it was ugly, as a sick calf or a rotten tooth is ugly, but because it was an obstacle in the middle of a cultivated field. It broke the pattern of work, scrambled the lines of cornrows. Worse, it shaded out, even with its pathetic growth, a big patch of ground, so that whatever was planted near it grew thin and was hardly worth harvesting. The tree stayed, though, and I did not know why, unless there was some faint hope that it might one day make a good log of lumber. I did not think about it consciously, because a child does not. Yet, my terror of the field went deeper than the simple unease of something being wrong. It was on a crackling hot day in July that I learned why the tree terrified me. It was my 12th summer, the last time of childhood, when the stirrings of adolescence are felt and the threat of manhood is at last revealed. Yet the unpredictable energy of childish still prevails, rushing to the surface now and then so that conflicting torrents tear a boy between his barefoot past and his shod future. I walked the lane between the drying fields, beside dripping grain and the dark green corn, past the mown hayfields where the first promise of summer had been harvested and which lay now dormant, and where the corn stalks reached towards fall harvest as I towards manhood. I trotted down the swamp and ducked through the tunnel of willows, crossed an opening and turned to where my father rode the horse-drawn cultivator through the corn. And I saw the man hanging in the cherry tree. He was black, not black as a person might be black, but burned black, as hell must be burned black by infernal heat. He was black with age, black from long exposure to the stains of time. His clothing was black, and his feet were anchored in the wind by black boots, which pointed down and marked the center of his eternal wind-blown swinging circle. The pivot of his endless dance. His hands were black, too, where they hung at his sides, black as if from long contact with leather stained by horse sweat. His nails were black as well, and broken as if from some kind of struggle. One arm hung oddly. My gaze was drawn up and held beyond my will, and I expected his eyes to be black too, but then I heard a crow caw somewhere, and I saw that there were no eyes in the sockets, but the holes where the eyes had been seemed black. I could not scream, although I tried. I ran to my father, who rose from his seat behind the cultivator, and I leapt on him. He was startled. He stopped the horses, which had not noticed anything because of their blinders, and I turned him to the tree where the man hung. But my father saw nothing. Still, he was patient with me, and I rode his lap to supper, but could not eat. My mother fed me warm milk and toast with sugar, and I went to bed early. And I wakened late, in the darkness of the child-forbidden hours, and heard voices, and crept to the stairwell, and listened. "I went to see Uncle Hugh," my father was saying. "You know how he is. If you buy him a beer, he tell you a story. I think he makes most of them up, but you can't be sure." I could hear the noises my mother made as she sewed. She had always had a special fondness for the old man, who was nobody's uncle as far as we knew. He was just some maternal instinct reaching out from her to his loneliness. At first he didn't want to tell me anything. Said nothing funny ever happened here and that he knew about. But after he had a couple of beers, he kind of grinned at me. God, his teeth are black and awful. Those he still got. And he started to laugh. "Long back, not after the Civil War," Hugh said. "Something funny did happen on this place." My, how would he know that? It was my mother. Is he really that old? Well, like I said, I don't know if any of this is true, but if he was a boy right after the Civil War, he'd be in his late 70s now. Maybe so. I don't rightly know how old he is. Anyway, as Hugh tells it, a traveling man came through here one time. You know, they were still scouting out the country for pine lumber then, and there was a hotel in town, so the stranger put up at the hotel and stayed for a few days. But he didn't seem to be scouting for lumber, or anything else anyone could make out. He was an odd one. And then one day, he paid his bill and started to leave town. Some of the boys noticed that he was leading two horses, and he just had the one when he came to town. So because he was such an odd one, they put it to him about them. Figured maybe he stole them, but he wouldn't tell him anything, and he tried to just ride off. Well, Tiny Johnson, I guess you wouldn't know him, but I just remember him, and they called him Tiny because he was so big. Tiny jumped him, and the first thing they knew, the stranger had a busted arm and was passed out. So they looked into his saddlebags and they didn't find any bill of sale or anything. Not that everybody had bills of sales in those days, but they did find some money in a bottle of good whiskey, and they shared out the money and drank the whiskey. And one thing led to another, and old Hugh's story is that they took him down a back road back toward the place here, and they went down a lane in the dark, and they found a tree out in the middle of the field, and they hanged him, higher in hell, from our old cherry tree. My parents were silent for a moment. The thing was, they found out the next day that he'd bought that horse, fair and square, and God knows why he didn't want to explain himself. So the boys, sobered up now, had to go out the next day and cut him down. Nobody'd seen him all that time, he being back in a field like that, but the crows got his eyes. The boys just threw the body back in the swamp, never even buried it. They set the horses loose, and pretty soon they turned up at somebody's farm that recognized them, and the farmer took them back to the fellow who sold them to the traveling man in the first place. Nobody ever came to inquire about it at all. In the pause, I could tell that my mother had stopped sewing. Then old Hugh, he laughed, that creaky old laugh of his, and he winks at me and he says, "Of course, this has nothing to do with you or me." "My God," my mother said. "He must have been one of those boys." I didn't think that, my father said. "I guess so. How else would he have known? Not the kind of thing the boys would have talked about, except among themselves." He paused. "But maybe he made the story up. Old men do, sometimes, just to have somebody listen to them." "Well, anyway," he said, with that voice of his that ended talk about things, like he said, "it doesn't have anything to do with us. I expect the boy imagined it, too." That time is 30 years past. My father is long dead, and I work the farm myself, and another nearby that I bought a few years ago. I do not believe in ghosts. The cherry tree is still dying. I have never seen a tree take so long at dying. It is a goddamn nuisance in that field, and if I get time this fall, I will take it down. This morning when I went back with the tractor and wagon to get a load of stone for the fireplace we're building in the new family room, the man was hanging in the tree again. I had not seen him there for a long time. It was early in the day when I went by, and I saw that black, dead, broken body twisting there. I could no more stop myself than I could on the first day I saw him, 30 years ago. This time the crows had gotten only one eye. Late in the afternoon when I went back again, the other eye was gone. I did not take my youngest son, who was 12, with me. I don't know what he would see. He can go alone tomorrow. By then I know the man will be gone. I do not think my son will notice that there are no crows in the field, that they are busy, noisy, deep in the swamp where the body lies. I will not tell my wife of this. She's from the city, and I do not want her to be frightened of the country. Thank you.
you, brave listeners, for joining me on another episode. You've been listening to In the Field of the Dying Cherry Tree by Curtis K. Statfield. I hope this puts you at ease now, Curtis, to be in the limelight once more. Thank you for your tale. Frightening Tales is a sponsor-free show whose mission is to share horror with the fans of horror. If you've enjoyed the stories you hear on my program, please delve into more work by these authors and buy their books at your local bookstore. If you'd like to show off your fan appreciation for Frightening Tales, purchase a shirt, stickers, or other swag and go forth as my army of walking billboards. Or if in the least, just spread the word. Do tune in again next Friday for another Frightening Tale, if you're brave enough.